Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum.
Blog Talk Radio.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Religion Means Alive with your host, Rashad El-Amin. I am your holistic instructor, holistic practitioner, naturopath, and teacher. I want to thank you for chiming in. I want to thank you, Man Alfred, for allowing me this time, every Thursday at 6 o'clock, share information on health for our community. Today we're going to be speaking about two topics. One will be on vaccines, and the other one that we touched on last week was about the coconut oil and the benefits of coconut oil. And I hope you took the information that I shared with you seriously last week, because what I shared with you will benefit you in all kinds of ways. And most of us, you know, we get information, we listen to it, but we don't apply it. We should learn how to apply good information, things that benefit us. And all of us need good health. Most of us, well, many of us, are in bad condition. And you go to your doctors hoping that they'll find something that will help reverse your condition and maybe you'll be able to get some relief. But as I said before, when you go to a doctor for any disease condition, they usually can't reverse anything for you. They can just treat it, put a Band-Aid on it, and send you home and hope that you get some relief from the pain. And that's what basically happens when, unless he's a holistic practitioner, then you might get your results. If you apply what they suggest that you should do for yourself. Because many of us, we listen and it just goes out the other ear. And we just lose out on the benefits of the information that would help us to get better. So I pray that you listen, take heed, and if you have some kind of problem, try to apply some of this information. If I had some kind of condition and someone was giving me information, I would try it, and it won't hurt to try, you see? Because in trying, you can see results, but if you don't try, you won't see any results. So it's best just to try. Now, we did touch on coconut oil last week. Coconut oil is a powerful weapon. Coconut oil coming from the coconut, and it's a special weapon.
Give me those people. I just played a tape because I had to make contact with Judge David. I mean, not Judge David, but Hassan El-Amin. He sits on the Maryland Court, Superior Court, Supreme Court, and he is actually with an intern from a court in Egypt who is sitting in. So I would just 1 second. We have the judge. Yes. So, dear people, we'll wait. Judge, I just spoke with Judge Hassan El-Amin, the Honorable Judge. We've come a long ways through the teachings of Imam Muhammad, and we were prepared by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad for the day of Imam Muhammad said that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad left us empty vessels, and he would put men in them. And we are a new people. It shows we have at least 5 sitting judges that are sitting in these United States. I would as happily assume very soon we're going to have African-American Muslims from our community sitting on the United States District Courts perhaps the United States Court of Appeal, and probably soon and very soon, even on the United States Supreme Court. I want to welcome now, we don't ask judges any questions about cases that are pending before any court. Those are what are called judicial ABA canons. Some of you may not know, I studied law formally in one of the last of the old law clerks in New York State. For some reason, the call of the member was stronger than the call of the bar, but I'm still excited by the appeal of the bar. I still love to go to courts and see cases tried, and in some ways or another, I'm still a trial fact. But I didn't formally become a trial fact as now as I am a pleader of facts, and I'm pleading our case in the court of public opinion and the global opinion. I'm just going to take this opportunity to welcome to us, to our audience. Religion means a lot. An audience that's composed of Muslims, Christians, Jews, and others, and wishing a happy Ramadan to Judge Hassan El-Amin of the Court of Record. I believe they call it the Supreme Court of the State of Maryland. He will give you the proper title and give us an opening statement as we welcome Judge Hassan El-Amin. Your Honor, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to Religion Means Alive and Ramadan Mubarak.
And Ramadan Mubarak to you, Brother Imam Alfred Muhammad, and assalamu alaikum to you as well and to your listening audience. I'm very pleased to be here. I am sitting in my office in the Circuit Court for Prince George's County, Maryland. I'm in the 7th Judicial Circuit of Maryland, which comprises Prince George's County, which is a very large urban county, probably the second largest jurisdiction in the state of Maryland. We have also St. Mary's County, we have Calvert County, and we have Charles County, which are sort of on the southern end of the Maryland Peninsula, west of the Chesapeake Bay. So we're very happy to be here this afternoon. And Brother Imam, it was ironic. I heard you say that the call of the minbar was stronger than the call of the bench. Didn't I hear you say that in your introduction?
Yes, sir. You certainly did. And early trained, there was a young man by the name of Mario. I knew him as Mario. We all were on 121st Street, and we were on the circuit. And one of the law offices I clerked in was David R. Dinkins.
Oh, yeah.
L. Eastman, who later on became judge, and they would spank me every day. He said, Brother, my last name was Booker. They said, Booker, when are you going to take the bar? Because I had registered New York and Pennsylvania and about 8 other states, what they call Commonwealth states. And in those states, if you clerk in a law office for 5 years as a registered clerk, you're eligible to set for the bar. But the bar just didn't. I never could get around to it other than still doing a few cases of bankruptcy prepared and helping some lawyers out in some cases. But I love it, but God has called me from an early age to proclaim his word. And
well,
I'm going to tell you, it sounds like you got the call too. I think you got 2 calls today. You're quite an eloquent speaker. Why don't you give us an opening statement and tell us who Judge Hassan El-Amin is and how he ended up being judge, how he ended up being lawyer, how he in fact ended up being in the Nation of Islam and in the community of Imam W.D. Muhammad, because I don't think you were born in Egypt. I don't think you were born in Africa. I suspect strongly you were born somewhere in these United States. But that's a suspicion, and in the law, suspicion is not sufficient. We have to have some evidence.
Yes, well, I was... Also, you're right, I got the call, but it's funny that you mentioned that because when I was in my 3rd year of law school, I went to law school at the University of Maryland at night, and I had a family. Night school was very tough to do. Shut that door, please. Night school was very tough, especially with a family. I had 7 children and a wife, and it was very hard to get to the law school, and I tried everything possible to almost get out of law school. As they say in law school, the first year they scare you to death, the second year they work you to death, and the third year they bore you to death. and you stretch that out in 4 years, and it's a very tough road to hoe. So I thought I had a calling because I had been reading the Gospel of Barnabas, and that, and together with my teachings of the on the Nation of Islam and the supreme, job or goal of being Tawhid, the unity, and this a gospel actually teaches unity and was against the Trinitarian doctrine, which really drove me away from Christianity. I'll go into that later. I wanted to go into the ministry and concentrate on the Gospel of Barnabas as one of the lost books of the Bible and talk about the Arian concept of God instead of the God that was developed in, under Paul, St. Paul. So I told my brother, I said, I think I'm getting ready to quit law school and go preach the gospel. You know what he said to me? This is my oldest brother, born in 1942. I'm born in 49, so he's 7 years older than I. He said, little brother, you better keep your black whatever in law school. We got enough preachers out here. We need some lawyers to help champion the cause of justice, because when a preacher comes, everybody sees him a mile away. Lawyers are more useful to our freedom struggle than preachers right now. So, you know,
I will tell you, your brother is a wise person. I don't say was, because that is very sagacious advice to have been given to you, and you are right. We are one of our plagues as a people is lots of preachers who can't do anything but preach, but they can't administer, can't establish systems. They don't can't even. They're not the preacher like Abdullah Muhammad who could establish business. If all you can do is preach, being honest with you, can't do very much.
Well, as a matter of fact,
now,
I think
yes.
I think our community, even the community which was, of course, under Imam W.D. Muhammad and Association, you know, we were very structured as a Nation of Islam. And then he transitioned into the American Muslim community, first the World Community of Islam in the West, then the American Muslim Mission. And finally, he just said, well, we're just Muslims following the Sunnah of the Prophet, peace be upon him. And we just sort of started fending for ourselves. And even today, we are not very well organized nationally. And I have found that the average imam, most of our imams are self-taught. They are, in most cases, very good, very devoted brothers. But, Imam Alfred, the problem, what they lack is organizational ability, the ability to manage the resources. Believers come to them from all walks of life and all avenues of endeavor and, you know, submit to themselves to their teaching, and then it gives a cat, and they want instructions. They want, like, as Ruby Dee, the late Ruby Dee says, you know, give us some assignments. Give me an assignment. Put me to work. What is your plan? And here the imam doesn't have a plan. The imam is not organized. No reports have been filed with the various legal jurisdictions. Taxes are missing. Payroll is shaky. And all of the legal requirements of the jurisdiction aren't met. And so the masjid or the Muslim community is really, in too many cases, too disorganized to function effectively, and you don't get the attention and the loyalty of 21st century educated people by being disorganized and by being managed by a crisis. That is a kind of an infirmity, a plague on our community. And I'm happy to say that in Washington, D.C., I still worship out of the Washington, D.C. mosque where I walked in the door in 1974, inshallah, never to come out again. You know what they say about the Muslims. They say, man, I don't know whether you want to go in that temple, because Dr. Shabazz was the minister, the late Abdul Alim Shabazz.
Oh, yes, I knew him as Dr. Lonnie Shabazz, Minister Lonnie.
Dr. Lonnie Shabazz. He just passed. We had his janazah I think he passed on the 25th of June. And we had his janazah right over the 4th of July holiday, right after the 4th of July holiday. And it was an amazing turnout, because we had representatives from the Nation of Islam there. We had brother, he's Nasheed now, but he was minister, Carl Foyx came out of Chicago, flew from Chicago to give statements, and we had, it was a wonderful, wonderful janazah. You know, even though our janazahs are very short, time was taken by our imam, Imam Talib Sharif, to acknowledge his contributions, because this brother, when he passed, was still professor of mathematics and chairman of the department at Grambling State University, and we're talking 87 years young. So he was 87. He died of basically pneumonia, and he'd gotten up in age, but he was very vibrant and active until his last days. So he was a great contributor, and, of course, he was educated at MIT and Cornell, I believe, and did graduate
That's
work.
And he, I just asked, he was at 19, graduate of Lincoln University, and 19
yes.
at MIT. And that tells you the caliber of leader that the Honorable Muhammad was and is. Well, I said was and is because he's still in my mind. If he can attract those kinds of people, and we attract the attorneys, this is something powerful. I want you to continue to tell us how the preaching profession lost a great champion. Because I know you, seen you, and I tell you something. When I spoke to you, I said, man, you know, something told me that you had started out on the path to being a preacher. I've been a preacher all my life, and I said, man, that man was a preacher. I can tell how he talked. I would not like to be a defendant in your court.
I got admitted to Yale Divinity School and Union Theological Seminary in 1970-71. But I had problems. See, I was raised in the Southern Baptist tradition, the African-American Baptist tradition, back in Charleston, West Virginia. See, I'm from West Virginia, Charleston, and my precursors there in West Virginia were the likes of Mordecai Johnson.
You got to first tell our audience who Mordecai Johnson is. I got to also tell you this
so
audience.
Mordecai Johnson was the first president, an early president of the modern Howard University.
African-American president. That's right.
Right, when it was the halcyon of higher education, let alone black higher education. Howard was not any place that you go to because you were black. Howard was a place that you went to because you were brilliant. And Mordecai and Vernon Johns, of course, who came out, who was a pastor of our church, was the predecessor of Martin Luther King, his church there in Alabama. Vernon Johns was such a militant that they ran.
Hey man, you know, brother, you know, I knew why I instantly loved you, Judge. Is because I just, you know, I didn't know, you know, I had come in contact with Vernon Johns. See, I came up out of Lynchburg, Virginia, Baptist preacher, started preaching when I was a kid, and that's why I listened to the likes of Vernon Johns, Mordecai Johnson. Vernon Johns had pastored. He was the president of Virginia Seminary in Lynchburg for a period of time.
We even had one of the favorite sons of West Virginia State, Leon Sullivan, the famous
Leon A. Sullivan. That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
And you know, I'm surprised at how few young blacks today recognize, and even whites recognize the contributions of the Reverend Leon Sullivan. He was the one who had the program. To industrialize a lot of and to give African Americans technical skills that were useful in the 70s and 80s, and also he was the founder of the Sullivan Principles, which helped lead to the dismantling of apartheid in South Africa. So Leon Sullivan was a great hero, and I never will forget to preach the sermon he preached at First Baptist, where the Reverend Moses Newsom presided. For so long, Leon Sullivan said, "Don't tell me what God can't do." And he took that theme, don't tell me what God can't do. And by the time it was over, we was all ready to bust through the ceilings of that church and go out and do somebody. And then those words always echoed to me with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad saying, up ye mighty nation, you can accomplish what you will. See, these people fed from the same plate. And in the Holy Quran, we have the Surah Ma'idah, you know, which you know is interpreted as the Last Supper, but it really means the meal that is sent down from Allah Subhanahu wa Taala to His servants, and it's a meal full of inspiration and spiritual enlightenment and power. And if you are supping from that table, then you can transform your reality, because you basically are one of Allah's instruments, one of His vicegerents on earth, and that's the whole point of human development, to be one of the Khalifa. And of course, the supreme Khalifa that we look at is the Prophet Muhammad, a beautiful, peace be on him, a beautiful example of the Uswatan Hasatan, the example par excellence of what a human being can do. We're not angels, but we can be God's, as a matter of fact, we're higher than angels. If it's properly understood, and I'm sure you and your audience do that, because unlike angels, we have free will. God gives us free will, and we can use that will to shape His creation and ourselves after His image, which, after all, is just peace, perfection, and power. Allahu Akbar. So look, oh, don't get me fired up now. Hey, are you still there?
We'll end up with a two-way sermon, because when you talk about the lust, and you know it is a shame, and it's really even a crime, that the Muslim African Americans don't know that great well that they come from. Next week, I'm going down to, God willing, inshallah, to Durham, North Carolina, to visit with one of the other great preachers, the Reverend Gardner Calvin Taylor. And, you know, I have committed the rest of my life to spreading the teachings of these great men. And Imam Muhammad is a combination of them. That's what we have to understand. He's a fulfillment of those great people. Benjamin Elijah Mays, Vernon H.B. Jones, Monica Johnson, Samuel DeWitt Proctor. We're not going to abandon those people. Those people are in our genes, are in our spirit.
Right.
And they were all leading to this path. And they were also very learned men. They were familiar with world religions. And we need to, I don't want to get to preaching, but I want to ask you to get back to how Judge Hassan al-Amin became, how did you end up coming into al-Islam, or into the Nation of Islam and onto al-Islam? Now, I know you told me you had six children. You're obviously a person that can go over obstacles to go to law school. Cut those big case books around, study brief cases, then go on and take care of family. I mean, man, you're a superman. Just
well,
your story.
I had a lot of inspiration. Let me say this. I was an overachiever in high school, and, you know, my mom told me real early, and also, I wanted to be a child of God. I've always felt close to God, close to the Creator. There was always in my heart just a closeness to this Creator manifests itself. And so the only, of course, vehicle I could use was the church. And unlike most of the teenagers my age, I sit right up front in the second pew, no further than the third seat from the rostrum. And, you know, I just wanted to, when church came, and I was always a good Bible student and everything else, and, you know, I did the best with what I had. But then I went away to college, and I got put in, you know, there's some very challenges at Yale University, because Yale is a great place, and I'm writing a book about my experiences at Yale. Yale's a great place if you know what you want and you know what you're doing. But at the time, I didn't know what I was, what I was doing, and what I wanted. And so it's a very dangerous place if you are you know, being molded, because there's so many forces, many of them very antithetical to, you know, good moral development. Now, intellectually, yes, it's an excellent environment, and you get all of these.
Let me ask you: Were you there when Skip Henry Louis Gates, also a fellow West Virginian, was there?
Yes, I was. Skip Gates was, I believe, a year behind me, as was Kurt Schmoke.
And tell us first who these two people is, and you were also there probably when John Blaxman came, the great historian, was there, right?
I don't know about that. I was there when Calvin Hill was there. Calvin Hill, the great football player at Dallas, who ended up being Rookie of the Year, he was there in 68, my senior year. And you know what? All the white guys, they would talk about Brian Dowling, how great he was. All the black kids, a few of us that were there, probably only a handful, maybe 25, we would talk about how great Calvin Hill was. And, of course, guess who learned out on top? Brian Dowling. You read about him in Doonesbury cartoons as a sort of a legendary character, but he never did anything on the football field. It was Calvin Hill and even his son, Grant Hill, the basketball player who ended up, doing well on the gridiron and also in life, because if you finish up at a school like Yale, you learn a lot of things in management and money management and rational development are among those things. Skip Gates, of course, has done fantastic, and also Kurt Schmoke. Now, Kurt was kind of a square, you know, to me, because, I mean, I was with the guys that were the more tended to tune in, turn on, and drop out. You know, I was one of the hippie-type Yaleys in trying to form, and Kurt was a very square. I mean, he was straight arrow. He knew exactly what he wanted. Like Woody Britton, who just Woody just passed. Unfortunately, I believe he developed either Lou Gehrig's disease. Yes, he was at the time he passed. And this is a classmate of mine, graduated in 1970, like I did. But he went on to Harvard Business School. But Woody knew right away that he wanted to go to business. And when he died, he was chief financial officer for, not Anderson, the largest accounting firm, not Dean Witter, a largest accounting firm in the country. I can't think of their name now, but these are the kind of guys. We were all overachievers in our own right.
Let me ask you this. Did you have any African-American professors at Yale when you were there?
No. The only person who I remember and coming just as a visiting professor was Eleanor Holmes North.
Wow.
I still love that lady, and, you know, she should be on the Supreme Court. But yes, she tells it too much like it is. Yeah, you know, our Supreme Court is a huge disappointment. And, of course, the biggest disappointment for me on the Supreme Court is the Honorable Clarence Thomas. Justice Thomas, your
fellow Yale. Went to Yale law school. Yes.
To the right of the former Chief Justice Rehnquist.
Yes.
And right in the bed with Scalia and Alito all the time. And you know what disappointed me? This is what disappointed me, Brother Alfred, is that he would not say anything at his confirmation hearings. He was too scared, and now he set a terrible precedent where all the witnesses who testify before the Senate committee won't say anything. We don't know what's in their head. We take, of course, their former rulings and their treatises, but everyone is so politically paranoid, so politically on pins and needles. They're afraid to be men, stand up, and say what's in their hearts. I just don't like that. I think it is a disservice to the public and an insult to the intelligence to have Supreme Court justices, nominees, get up there and say nothing about nothing. I can't countenance that. Now, Justice Thomas succeeded the Honorable Eleanor Holmes Norton at the EEOC. I know because I worked for the Civil Service Commission, the first good job I had after I got back from a year traveling in France and whatnot. I took the exam and did pretty well on it, and I got hired by the Civil Service Commission. Very boring job, but it did pay bills. And soon I went back there after I had gone into the Nation of Islam. I went back to the Civil Service Commission, which became OPM. We did discrimination complaints in government, and we did federal EEO, Equal Employment Opportunity. Elder Holmes Norton was at the EEOC initially.
Have you had occasion to meet Mr. Justice Thomas?
No, sir, because what happened is one of our – I was president of our African-American Bar Association here in Prince George's County, which is named after a pioneer, Frankie Bourne, J. Franklin Bourne Bar Association here. And someone had the temerity to suggest that we invite Clarence Thomas as our guest speaker. Every year we have outstanding guest speakers, such as we had the late Johnny Cochran, we had Marion Wright Elliman, we've had Eric Holder. And I'm proud to say that I was instrumental in being able to get the legendary and incomparable Harry Belafonte to speak to us. And his message still resonates. The challenges that he gave us still resonate, because Harry is a genuine. And you know what happens is, because the bar association that I belong to is made up primarily of African American females. You know, black women are still in large proportion more than black men. We had a scholarship affair the other day, a new admittee reception. I was able to host it, my wife and I, as a matter of fact. There were 12 new admittees to the bar of the state of Maryland, African-American. Only two of them were brothers, and 10 of them were women. And
let's get to that point. This is a very critical point, particularly as you start talking about our imams and our challenges, us leaders' challenges. It seems to me we are missing out on something. That we have African-American men, and I know as a judge, as a sitting judge, I want you to explain to the people what a sitting judge means, is that you see large swaths of our young men coming as defendants in your court, but yet at the same time, you find very small numbers of us appearing before you as lawyers, being admitted to the bar. What's wrong with that picture, and what can we as Muslims and what human beings do about that? Because it seems to me that's a national crisis, and I believe if Mordecai Johnson were around, they would say something about it. I know Imam Muhammad was on the case. I know Leon A. Sullivan, Dr. Leon A. Sullivan, the founder of the Opportunity Industrialization Centers that taught men how to walk, taught women how to walk, how to talk, even taught them how to put a suit on. And,
right.
You know, while we talk about that, these for-profit schools are taking out kids and ripping them off. I don't want you to discuss that because there may be matters that have come before you. But I do say there is a crisis among African-American males, and it seems to me that our preachers, our imams, our rabbis should be addressing that.
Well, you know, our problem, brother, you've been to the prisons and the jails, the lockups. That's where our nation is. We got intelligent, able-bodied, sharp, brilliant, and highly capable young men by the thousands and tens of thousands who are locked up because they made foolish decisions. And that has to do with the almost total disintegration of the black family and the failure of this government and this society and our own selves to demand reconstruction. You see, the problem is we never got reconstruction. We were just let go in 1864, and when the Emancipation Proclamation happened, of course, the slaves were like, well, where can we go? You know what Harriet Tubman famously said after she freed 300 and more slaves after she went back south 19 times. She said, if I could have convinced more slaves that they were slaves, I would have freed thousands. So we as African, as a free people of African descent, we didn't really want to leave the plantation. But when we did leave, we were in shambles. And it was fortunately in the Jim Crow era of the early 1900s, and during Reconstruction, we had more integrity because we were more oppressed and we relied on our own. When integration came, it was both a blessing and a curse in the 1950-1954, because although we, at least titularly, had exposure to more opportunities, the bottom line is we went out for the bling bling. We've gone now for the bling bling. The family is disintegrated. 70% of black men grow up in households with no male head of household. So we're being raised in a matriarchal system, and the women are taking care of the natural born business, which is have children, make sure they're well cared for, pay bills. You know, one of my jobs, Brother Imam Alfred, is to preside over child support contempt hearings. And I'm telling you, it's one of the saddest courtrooms you ever want to see. If you want to hear a pity party, if you want to see some pathetic examples of how far we've fallen, you sit one day in a child support contempt court, and you see how many of us, our black males, our young Africans, are doing the physiological thing, the animal thing, copulating with members of the opposite sex, but are in no position to support those who are the product of their loins. So naturally the woman is left with this responsibility, and we, like so many ex-slaves and slaves, are just propagating but not rearing children. And this is a shame and a disgrace, and it is not being addressed. And so many of us end up trying to shortcut, selling drugs, which is, you know, a dead end, listening to our foolish peers who themselves are headed off for jail, and there is no one, no program, no nothing right now to address, as the man Muhammad called for, and I'm sure you've heard this, the continuing effects of slavery on the African-American people and what must be done.
Well, but Your Honor, I want to announce to you and your guests and to the public that that's what religion means alive is a setup for. If you look at our tagline on the computer, you'll find that that's what we address. We are not, you know, I know there's a lot of competent imams in the masjid, masajid, but I don't think we have any competent people out here addressing the public. And that's what my mission is. I've committed for the rest of my life on July the 25th, which is Friday, God spared my life. I would have been on the planet 67 years.
Alhamdulillah.
And I made a promise to Almighty God and to the public. And I made this promise to Imam Muhammad that I was going to spend the rest of my life working, addressing the effects of slavery. I'm going to be visiting cities throughout the United States to address our men. I think this is a tragic. I don't think we should pick up a subject unless we do it.
Every year I coordinate an oratorical contest for high school students in Prince George's and Montgomery counties. And I am so gratified by the intelligence and vision that comes from these kids. We offer $1,000 scholarships as first place, and we also have, you know, plaques and prizes. Last year's subject, or this past year, 2014 subject, was exactly that. It was, do African Americans still suffer the effects of slavery? And Imam Alfred, I was amazed at the enthusiasm and cogency with which these high school students addressed that issue. And do you know that many of them had heard of the how to make a slave? What's that?
The Willie Lynch myth. Yeah, the Willie Lynch story.
Willie Lynch story. They refer to that by name, and the darker skinned sisters who gave their orations recalled vividly being discriminated against and looked down at by the lighter skinned sisters and the white folk too because of the darkness of their skin. They go through that on a daily basis still. You see, this country is awash in white supremacy and racism, and until it's addressed, it will continue to fester because it's just a plague, it's a disease. It actually comes from Shaitan, who said, I am better than he. When God says, listen, I'm going to make a black man, I'm going to make a human being fashioned out of dark mud, fashioned into shape, and Shaitan says, no, that he doesn't qualify. I qualify. You made me from fire, from knowledge. You can't make anything from a pot, from something that will reflect your sound, your shape, your spirit. And so these white supremacists have run off with the world, and now they got everything from the Tea Party to the right-wing support of these causes. And I'm always wondering, why is the South still running this country? You see, when Abraham Lincoln, let me get back to my point of Reconstruction or the like thereof, when John Wilkes Booth, with the assistance of many, many people, assassinated Abraham Lincoln, he set this country back, I say, at least 100 years, if not 200 years, because what we were supposed to get in Reconstruction are 40 acres and a mule, and more than that, an opportunity to be self-reliant, self-dependent, and do something for ourselves. When that was taken away from us, we haven't recovered since, brother. We haven't recovered since, and now, since the civil rights, since we got access to the lunch counters and the bling-bling and everything that we wanted, we are in a free fall because there is no charter, there's no mantra, nobody's given us assignments. And, you know, the NAACP is too slow and too bogged down in issues all over the place. We don't have any champions. And people are relying on Barack Obama to be a champion. Well, he can't even control the ship of state because it's such a huge vessel. And he's doing what he can, but if his presidency has shown us anything, it's that the power of the president is limited. It is basically a symbolic office. It does have command and control of the military to a certain extent, but even that is limited because of America's policies. So what we can do, though, brother, is do what we can in our own communities. That's why I like Prince George's County, because this county, which recently, unfortunately, had to deal with the passing of its champion county executive, Wayne K. Curry, who really brought the Prince George's County into the modern era. This county is composed of probably the most the African Americans with the most earning power. I won't say wealthiest because we're not wealthy. We just have earning power, and most of us live from paycheck to paycheck, but they're big paychecks, right? A lot of people are making six
figures. Isn't that a part of the legacy of slavery? You know, we're going to come to Washington, I believe, for the Congressional Black Caucus.
Oh, my God.
15,000 African Americans, well-meaning African Americans.
You talk about plantation. There's one, buddy.
And you know what? You will see that those 15,000 African Americans that come there probably have maxed out their credit cards to be there. We still are suffering from what Booker D. Washington described as up from slavery. And I just don't believe that a lot of us as Muslims get it. I think we think that since we are Muslims and our name is now Muhammad, our name is Al-Amin, our name is that we have escaped these problems. But I think we have swept them under the rug. I think we're just as bad a shape as a people. If we get on the job now and go to work to change our people's circumstances, you know, because, you know, I want to ask you about these historical African American colleges in high school. You know, Howard University, my daughter has been just admitted to school social work, but it is teetering on the border of bankruptcy. Because of the fact that African Americans, once we get a dollar over a mortgage sandwich, we rather go to one of the very expensive stores and buy a brioni rather than reaching back in our pocket and say, let me do what that Judge Al-Amin did, is holding an oratorical contest. It seems to me Muslims and African American middle class have an obligation and a debt to pay to our people. I mean, Rhonda Robinson wrote a book called The Debt. And
right.
I think we owe a debt to each other. Would you agree with that?
No, there's no, but yeah, because, you know, we say we want paradise, we say we love, but you know, the whole thing is you love for your brother or your sister what you love for yourself. So, I mean, a Muslim who wants a heavenly state of mind, and the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he couldn't go to bed. He couldn't go to sleep knowing there was extra money in the house that had to be distributed. So we should always be looking for an object to share our blessings with. And this is how a Muslim thinks. It's just that, and some of us have been caught up in this ritual, brother, where we're trying to make, we want to go to Arabia and go to Egypt and take on their culture. And, you know, we have a pathology among us anyway. Black people are always trying to be everything but black, even Muslims. And so a lot of the African-American Muslims want to escape to some foreign culture and import their problems over here, you know, with the women all veiled up, walking behind and all that nonsense. You know, I have five daughters, and I remember going to the masjid at the University of Florida, and they had the sisters' entrance around the back. You had to go past the garbage can. Then they had a little door, and the door led up to a balcony, and they had a little black and white TV, and they were totally screened out from the masala, the big part. Now, what African American woman is going to tolerate that second, third class treatment? None. So don't bring those arcane and tired mores over here. Be progressive. Understand that. We need all resources, men, women, children, to focus on. So, you know, people, Muslims should not be in the background trying to figure out how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. That's what sank Christianity. And some of us have fallen into those same backwards ways. So we
but
have
brother,
to...
Can I say amen? Will that be acceptable? Because it's so true. You know, I'm just going to shut up and listen because I'm telling you, we're never going to make progress as a people.
Well, you see, the thing is, I believe what Booker T. Washington said, put down your bucket where you are. You see, we can't save the world. You know, I cry at what's happening in the Middle East. I'm so angry and frustrated. There's so much injustice. We know the arc of the moral universe is long, and it leads to justice. But boy, you know, we would like to see some justice in our time to the native citizens of that part of the world, the Palestinians, who have been totally displaced and are, you know, just desperate. So they do desperate things. But I can't help that. I can't do that. I mean, I might, you know, be able to send some money here and there if it doesn't go to the wrong place and get and then I get on some terrorist watch list because they, you know, whatever. But anyway, but I can do something in Upper Marlboro, Maryland, or in.
And you know what? What you all call it in the law when you join in the decision. Well, you know, on the appellate court. Well, let me tell you something. I'm going to join you.
Affirm.
Affirm. But you know what I'm going to say to you, a judge. I also ate in pain at 100 African Americans that was killed 2 weeks ago in Chicago on a weekend. Now we talk
about
these things quite out.
How about that? Well, that's a good example of not looking overseas but looking at home. So what is the problem there? And I'll tell you what the problem is there. Again, the disintegration of our family. Brother Alfred, we learned our morality. I don't know about you, but I learned my morality at the dinner table. I learned my grammar at the dinner table. I mean, and that's what was happening all over where we live. Now, I would hazard to guess that most of the people eat less than one meal with the whole family seated a week. People are going.
And you know,
and I'm like, you want to make some money? Build a restaurant in the black community. I don't care what it is. Black Eyed Pea, have a pizza place, the Chinese restaurant. Oh yeah, we got mumbo sauce for you. What we got mumbo sauce for you. We're doing everything, but helping and serving ourselves.
Even if we have them chicken brains from the Chinese, we won't even eat them together. We'll eat them in separate rooms with the TV on. Sometimes we have five TVs on in our home. So I mean, there's some simple things we can do.
Sit down
at the table and eat a meal together.
The family is the basic unit of civilization. You cannot raise a human being without a family. And so as the impulses come from the market, from the Satanists, the supremacists, from the mostly people who want to exploit us, come into this little seed that no longer has, it's like a seed core of an apple. It no longer has the fruit of the apple to protect it. The skin of the apple is gone. That's daddy, mom, and family. So what's happening? This person being bombarded, and all they got in there is contemporaries, little seeds that don't know anything anyway. And they end up in court. And you know what is really embarrassing, Brother Alfred, is to have, when I was a district court judge and I did bond reviews, you know, by the pound, I mean like, you know, 30, 40, 50, even sometimes 60, to see Abdul Shahid, Abdul Majid, Abdul, because the ABDUL is always first on the alphabet, and here's a young man, sometimes older man, but usually young people who got these names that we struggled and strove for, that we, in some cases, died and sacrificed for. They come in with these attributes of God, these holy names, so to speak, and they number one and two on the lockup list for crime.
What do you think? What do you think went wrong there? What do you think went wrong there? And that's in jurisdiction. It's very embarrassing. It is really. I mean, I know as a judge, you as a Muslim judge, it's an embarrassing thing. You know, I mean,
I was told very early in my career when I took the bench by some friendly folk. They said, Hassan, you got to be patient with the deputies and the sheriff's deputies and the bailiffs and the marshals when it comes to your name and you know, the protocols that are proper. He said, you have to realize that most of these guys, their only contact with names like yours were from inmates.
Yes, 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 yes. You know, and that, see, what, here's another problem for us. I remember in the Nation of Islam days, if a man committed a crime, he would come under Willie or under Tree and John Churchill. He would not come under a Muslim name. He was ashamed. Now people are proud. You know, I talked to a young brother the other day. He said, Brother Imam, I was in the sit-gen. I said, Brother, you weren't in the sit-gen. You were in jail. And you were
defendant. That's what he calls
a sit-gen, huh? Yeah, yeah. You were a criminal defendant. So I said, you know, I just have to get you straight. I can't let you be misled. You committed a crime. He said, well, Malcolm. I said, Malcolm, pre-Nation of Islam. Well, I'm like, Mom, I stopped him. I said, Brother, you are not those men at all. You were a common criminal. You know, I talked to him as a brother. I told him I love you. I'm old enough to be your daddy, your granddaddy. But I think that we have done it. We have abandoned these young people and talking to them what Paul Ferreira called a pedagogy of the oppressed. We can't play games with them. And if you all support what I'm doing, I intend to go to every neighborhood we can do up and down this East Coast and community centers, have poetry contests, oratorical contests, and attract our young people and address them from our heart. That's what we need to do. Our messages should lead the way and bringing our people back to sin. I want to ask you, Judge, you've said in a part which is a very sad part, and that is to sit in the part of the child support part. But I want you to, well, I got so many questions. One of the questions I want you to finish up is one of the reasons you're right that people in the criminal justice system, you know what a man told me? So you know what? You're the first Muslim I met that wasn't an inmate. I said, well, I'm glad you, I represented that. I said, I've not even been arrested.
Whoa.
And another damn shame that now Islam is associated with criminality. You know, a guy, I would change my name to Willie Bobo if my name was Abdul Shamsuddin. I would not wear a Muslim name. You know, and then want to go to jail and get halal food. You know, I wasn't, I'm telling you.
They insist on it. That's right.
Yeah, you know what?
Remember that man, the sniper, who they said was John Allen Muhammad?
John Allen Muhammad, let me tell you.
I think it was John Allen. I don't think he had changed his name. Had he changed his name formally? I want to know.
I think he did. But you know what? He was in a form of what's called Nate Mistom that doesn't require people to respect. But I hate to tell you, Judge, and you can't rule on this, I was happy when my great state of Virginia escorted him to the death chamber and put him to death.
I know. I was, too. You know what? Because I was ducking and dodging. I was doing a Z line instead of a B line. I, like thousands of others, were doing a Z line from the pump to the for the front door of the gas station. Man, he had us all. That was a terror. And plus, the evidence against him was so great that the death penalty was warranted.
It was certainly warranted. And, you know, and then he messed up a young man's life. I mean, a young man who's in prison for the rest of his life. This guy was a lowlife. You know, and what made me mad with him, he stumbled as he went to the gas check, to the death house. I mean, he should have walked and been proud like this other criminal that was killed by the United States government. What's his name? The man from the Oklahoma bombing. At least he stood up as a man. Timothy McVeigh. He went out like a man. At least I don't condone him. But I told John, so-called John Muhammad, but he stumbled when they said they were going to take him to death.
No, but he was
a coward.
McVeigh was waging war, so he thought of himself as a martyr. But John Allen Muhammad was... he was a miscreant and a sociopath, and you're right. That young boy, Malvo, with him.
Yes.
But I was lucky, as you were, brother. When I joined the Nation of Islam in 1974, I was a very angry person, and I had finally rejected Christianity because it didn't answer intellectually. I mean, how can you reconcile the Trinity? How can God be Father, Son, and Holy Ghost if that's the problem? How can Christ say on the cross, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? I mean, if he was God, how could he do that? He knew who God was. And then all this stuff that you have with these, there's just too many contradictions. And that one was just a fundamental one. So I didn't like that, but I didn't like the phoniness of the Panthers and all these other black nationalist organizations. So finally, my sister ended up joining the Nation of Islam, and I saw that she was in the masjid in Asheville, North Carolina. And although she had some problems with her husband, who ended up wanting more than one wife and all that stuff, it was beneficial for her. I saw her change her diet and eat whole wheat muffins. She would bake those muffins, gingerbread. Her complexion improved. Her attitude became really good, and she had a lot of answers. So I went down there, and I saw Minister Larry spit and spumble, and he didn't impress me. But then I was in Washington, so I came and I saw Dr. Shabazz, and I said, well, this man is very, very impressive. And listen, they asked the question. I went to the lecture. They said, if you give up alcohol and chasing women and doing all these things, smoking cigarettes and all this stuff, you can save yourself $21.50 a week. And I did the math. I said, well, that's right. So when they said, how many people said that what we said is right, I stood up because it was right. And that's what I
did. You didn't know what you were standing up for, though.
Yeah,
you didn't know what you were standing up for.
And listen, to work, brother Alfred. They put
that's
me to
right.
work.
That's exactly right. They put a bundle of papers on your arm.
Every other black
right.
organization I was in, including Boy Scouts, Baptist Youth Fellowship, the Jack and Jill, the Black This, the Black, all of them always had some agenda, some political thing, and they always were involved in my personality. You know, I think I'm all this. I come from this side of town. You, Yale, all this bull. The Muslims said, no, this brother can write. He knows the English language. We're putting him to work. He's going to be Secretary Vernon 7X or Vernon X Jones. He's going to be Secretary. I was a secretary to the captain. That kept me out of the chain of command. You know, it gave me a nice little niche underneath the captain to work out. And I took my 300 papers. I quit my job, my federal job, and signed on the fish truck. And I was a top fish producer. I loved it. I had a saturation
experience. But let me ask you this. What was your wife's reaction? What was her reaction to all of this? Were you married at the time?
I married in 74. I joined the Nation in 72. And then she already had four kids, and she had her ex, and I wasn't qualified to marry her until I got an ex. But we had a short courtship, brother, but, I mean, the thing was, are you going to marry her and help provide for her? Because we treated the sisters with great respect, as you know.
That's right.
We walked them to their cars. We took them home in the back seat. We didn't court. We didn't have there was no premarital sex and all this other stuff. We honored our vows, and courtships were short. So my courtship with my wife was only about 60 days. So, I mean, it was whether I'm going to marry her or not. And so I said, well, she got four kids, and she managed those kids like little ducks when she was, like on Lake Erie. When the mama duck goes out, those little ducks fall right out. I said, this woman is the MGT, GCC, Muslim Girls training and general civilization class. She can cook, sew, knows how to keep house, knows how to keep her business private. And brother, that was 40 years ago in September, and Allah has blessed us to be more and more in love each day.
Alhamdulillah. I saw y'all in Washington. Y'all look like a newly. What is brother matter, sister? He looks like he just married. Cause you know you can see the brother just got married. Then you can see the brother been married 10 years. He looks like his misery on his face. She does too. But you all look. So what are your children doing now? Are they in the professions?
I'm very lucky. I have a daughter who's an engineer. She went to University of Maryland Eastern Shore, started, and she was a late bloomer, but she discovered that her, and it comes from her dad's side too, very, very mathematically inclined. So she's an engineer, one of the very few black female engineers that actually practicing. And you know what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, what? Study engineering.
That's right.
So she's helped build the Tanger Mall. She's building, helping now with a Walmart, and she is a person in demand. I have one son who is in air conditioning and refrigeration. He is also assistant building manager at the Smithsonian Institute. He just turned 51. He was older. He was 16 when his mother and I got married. Yeah, 40 plus 16. He wasn't 16. He was 11. Yes. Then one was a retired police officer. He was the most mischievous one, ironically, and he's got a disability, but he's now starting an IT business. He actually woke me up from a nap this morning, going to a meeting, and he's very productive. He's married and has one son. I have a daughter who is a lawyer. My baby is a lawyer. She just came back from a advanced seminar on trial techniques, and she's a lawyer here in Prince George's County, blazing the trail. And it's, you know, kind of a burden to have a father who's a judge, but she carries her own, and she puts people at ease, and she is has very high standards.
She's a trial attorney. Does she practice in the area of court?
She does family law, which is booming.
Okay.
You know, they got more divorces, and I do a lot of child custody cases. That's another thing, Imam Alfred. This is sad, these custody cases. where these people have these babies, they lie down with each other, and they may have a relationship for maybe 6 months if it's good, a couple of years, and sometimes they even get married. And they produce a child, and
you have the real Mary Povich show, only it's a real litigant. I mean, this, you know what saddens me? If you turn on the TV early in the morning, they give these young people, it's like it's something of entertainment to them. That mm-hmm. They don't know the paternity. It's really sad.
Oh, and it's getting more complex now because as homosexual rights rise to the level of the same rights that everyone enjoys. And to be honest, the Equal Protection Amendment protects you no matter what your sexual orientation are. And so, that's just a good point. That's here, whether regardless. You can't discriminate it on that basis. But
I was just reading something recently on American reproductive law. Now surrogacy. Sued a...
Surrogacy is coming to the fore where sometimes you don't even know who the sperm donor is. You got ex sperm donor from the bank. You got a surrogate mom in whose place, and then it is adopted by the other surrogate, and then that's okay as long as it's together. But guess what? There's no refuge in lesbianism or homosexuality. They have the same problems that the heterosexual
have. That's what I was going to just say. Men should be aware, and this is totally to our listening audience, it may be Muslim or non-Muslim. You know, there's a case winding through the Georgia courts, I believe, right now, one of the courts, wherein someone is suing a sperm donor. And the man was actually, he agreed to be a donor, but now the courts have ruled he has to pay child support. So, you know, all this experimental legalisms, it's coming, winding down. So we as Muslims have to start having our own rulings. You know, I'm not waiting for somebody who's been trained at LSR to give any rulings. That's another trend that's taking place among us.
That's another quagmire.
Yeah, that's a quagmire for us.
Listen. I know one of the brothers who supported me for a long time, who was an Islamic scholar. I mean, and he has his PhD in Sharia. He's from the Sudan, and he has a PhD in law as well. And you know what he says? He says, "Look, we don't want Sharia here. You all don't want Sharia." Those people who have Sharia don't want Sharia. Please don't bring Sharia here because it is, number one, so controversial, even among the Islamic jurists. And then in its application, see, it can't conform to the year zero or the year one of the Prophet's time, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. It has to conform to the norm because you can't have cruel, unusual punishment with people's right and left hands being lopped off because these people are taking things literally instead of symbolically as they should, but you know it's stuff is easy to interpret on the physical level. So we don't want that. We don't want what we need. American law is fine, brother. You know it's fine because the Constitution, in its essence, respects the divinity of each human being, and that's the beautiful part that God put into man. Certain unalienable rights, right? And they can't be taken away. They shouldn't be taken away. And each of us has those rights. And as we know, many of the founders were Muslims anyway. They were closet Muslims called Masons. But American law is fine. But law takes time to catch up with social developments. And with the advent of technology, see, technology is outstripping everything. So law takes a long time. Because it requires legislation, and legislators can hardly agree on the time of day now. It's just a symptom of the, you know, it's just this, a symptom of the time that we're living in. So there is so much here, but the bottom line is that We need to be effective where we can be effective. And I love that that serenity prayer. God, grant me the power, the courage to think, to change the things I can.
And the wisdom,
courage of things, to change the things I can, the patience, what to do with the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference, something like that. So I think that's really important to have that faculty of discernment. You know the surah Al-Araf, the seventh surah in the Quran, which we say is the heights. I never forget, but one brother, Muhammad, Aslam, has translated that as the heights. I love that translation because it gets away from the physical, and it's talking about the high plane, the high thinking, the high behavior. And so I just believe that we are in a stage now, particularly with the legacy of Imam W.D. Muhammad, who's sharing so much light on what the scriptures actually mean, that we can, all we have to do is apply what has been taught and be human, good human beings, good people. Like you say, these brothers who have committed criminal acts, are criminals. They need a rehabilitation. They need to be shamed, and once you're shamed, you can reform. But you gotta you have to be ashamed of what you did, so that humility can grow into you, so that you can change your behavior and
Let me ask you. About the complexities surrounding our dear law professor sister, and I want to invite you once to be on a panel with another former law professor and legislator, Yusuf Abdul Salam. He comes on every Friday on our program, and he also currently prosecutes, but finally he was one of the first state legislators. I'm going to ask you about, I want to put together a panel, perhaps with some of you all, like Michelle, and along with the discussion of Michelle Alexander. So I think what we're doing, I think we're beginning to romanticize the criminal lifestyle. I think, you know, I don't believe that this is a new Jim Crow. I think that there's a breakdown. I want you to just give your reaction to Michelle Alexander.
Yeah, I just ordered her book. I haven't read it cover to cover, so I mean just read excerpts of it. But in a sense, she's right. If her thesis is that this is pre-designed, it's pre-designed to slip for African-American, particularly African-American boys, young men. They're not quite men because, as we know, men means mind. A developed man is a mind.
But
the problem is these brothers are not thinking with their minds. They're thinking with other organs, and they are way out of balance. But they're just being funneled into the prison system because their basic formation, the family, see the unit that creates the human being, that nurtures and makes a person or a child, and the socialization of the child is so important, and the family unit. Without a family, You can't do anything but try to find a family. And then if you don't find a family, then you're left to fend for yourself. And so that's predictable. In other words, these same children back in the before the Emancipation Proclamation, before the end of slavery in 1840, 1850, they were just picking innings. And it behooved the masa to have as many pickaninnies as possible, because they were growing us like corn. They were growing us like cattle. And so as many, you got a mandingo who's just putting his thing in every female slave he could, and they're having babies, because when he wasn't there, Massa was in there double time, and his wife who was up in the big house. So, I mean, we were just basically being propagated. And so that, unfortunately, it's continuing to happen, and when people don't have any jobs, people don't have any education, the first thing they do, brother, is drop out of school. And they do that because family pressures are not as strong as peer pressures. So they make the terrible decision, drop out of school, and then they're useless. And then they turn to crime. And it's predictable. As everybody knows, that's why they have stock in Correction Corporations of America and all these other people. And they're just warehousing us by the hundreds and tens and hundreds of thousands, even the millions. So the system is designed to capture us as basically slaves.
Jeff, I want to ask you a question about something that is a new trend in criminal justice. It's not really new, but it's increasing. You know, when I was an imam in Maryland, I used to go to the women's prisons. I'm just going to be honest with you. I've stopped visiting prisons. I don't go to prisons anymore. I don't do any of that kind of work. I'm out here on the outside trying to prevent people from going to prison. Once they go to prison, I've got to leave them to you.
Well, let the prison ministry. Each mosque, each masjid has a prison ministry, and some of them are very good. You know, you got to... The bottom line is all this Islam that they're learning in the prison, all this, what do they do when they come out?
That's the point I'm making. All it seems to me to do is making jobs. I think our imams would be better served if they worked on the outside with Ray Ray and Stinker and Rodney and all of them right now and invite Rodney and them to a public address.
Right.
And also Keisha, too, because I want to ask you about Keisha. Because it seems to me that in criminal court now, I'm noticing a lot more women defendants. I mean, the federal prison system had to be, they used to have one women's prison. Now I think they up to 20 women facilities. I don't know, I'm in the state of Maryland. At one time when I was working in Maryland, there was one women's prison. But what is going on now?
Well, that's always the trend, brother. The Muslim, you know, I remember when the women wouldn't smoke pot. We used to bring reefer to the party, and the women were like, what are y'all doing that for? You know, because, you know, pot would make you tune out and just sort of get to yourself. You really weren't social. Alcohol, on the other hand, would make you more social, right? You remember that?
Yes, sir. I do remember that. Yes, sir.
That's what the women started doing, smoking pot, just like it was.
Hey, you know, back in the days, you and I would have been hanging out together because I loved pot at that time. You know, that's another drug that I'm going to ask you about that, too, because I think that we are minimizing. We call it weed, but it's really a gateway drug to cocaine and all the rest. I think that's being minimized. But let's address the women problems. The thing of women, continue on about the women, yes.
Well, we have a problem that we have a matriarchal society, and the women, you know, they claim they want a good man. But, brother, when you bring a man who is a developed mind and is a decision maker, he catches hell. And number one, they still have this romantic fantasy. So many of them, they want this tall, they want the basketball player instead of the hardworking brother who Aretha Franklin talked about. This is the house the Jack built. That's the kind of man that they should want.
That's right.
But then they diss Jack because Jack ain't giving them all the stuff that they want. And Jack is a hardworking man. So I love that song because and that's why we love Aretha, because Aretha teaches more about life in her songs than all these rap songs combined forever. and this hip hop and rap are another terrible influence on the young people that glorifies. A gangster is the glorified empty ego. Me, me, me. I. You know, talking about how great they are, how much they can get over, and all this other stuff. It's all ego. It's just so phony, but it's selling by the zillions, and it's even overseas. But you know what? The thing about is Caucasians who buy that stuff. As I found out, you know, the white people, they go along with it, and the kids go along with it, but when they start to grow up, and this is what happened with pot. You see, you should outgrow pot. You might go through a phase where you are getting high and whatever, but then you see that it doesn't get you anywhere, and pretty soon, you know, you just get high, you get sleepy, you want to get the munchies, and, you know, and you find out that, hey, this stuff is not really improving my situation, so I'm going to put it down, because when I was a child, I spoke as a child, I behaved as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things. That's just a natural development. But because if your family life, if your basic human structure is not properly installed, then you don't have that compass. You don't have that moral line that needs, you know, the backbone that needs to straighten you up. And so you end up falling off, and you're going to the wrong path. As the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, we are easy to lead in the wrong direction, hard to lead in the right direction. And, you know, don't forget, we were a very small society, Brother Alfred, very small. We were a fringe group, basically, but a very powerful one because we had such a powerful leader and such a powerful tradition, you know, and a very powerful doctrine in the largely mythological teachings in terms of, you know, who was God and who was the black man and all this other stuff. But symbolically, it was very powerful. And I was glad to be able to give up white supremacy for a while because being from Charleston, West Virginia, I never saw a black pilot. I never saw a black banker behind, you know, the that last desk making decisions. I saw school teachers, and I saw janitors. I saw post office workers. I saw other, you know, functionaries, but I never saw African Americans at the lead. And it wasn't until I came to Washington, D.C., and I saw the pilot of the plane was black. Boy, I almost jumped off that plane. As, by the way, one racist was a newspaper. I forget her name. She saw a black woman who was that? She saw a black woman piloting a plane and said, "This is affirmative action. Gone wild. I'm getting off this plane." They made a big stink about that, as they should have. I don't know her name, but she's part of the white supremacist structure. But our women they just need leadership. Women need the leadership of men.
I want to ask you about one of your fellow Yaleys and West Virginians. That is Professor Henry Louis Gates.
Skip Gates.
Professor Gates has produced a movie called documentary called Many Rivers to Cross. And I had the opportunity to ask the director, Schoenberg, who is an acquaintance of his, I don't know if he's a friend, why did Professor Gates decide to leave the Muslims out and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad out of the film? He asked Professor Gates. So can you explain why, in your legal understanding, philosophical and theological understanding, why would Professor Louis Gates, I know he's a competent man, attended Yale University or at Chicago or something, why would he leave out one of the most important historical figures in America, particularly among African Americans? Why do you think he would do that?
Well, you think the question is deliberate, or is it a function of what his producers wanted? Or is it deliberate? You see, you cannot leave Islam out of the freedom movement in America because Honorable Elijah Muhammad is responsible for black pride. Period. Period. From everything from James Brown saying, "Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. I'm black and I'm proud." He acknowledged getting that from the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And it was the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, you know, we were going around calling ourselves Negroes, colored, coon shines, whatever. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, "None of it. I'm not taking none of that. You were black." And he just kept pounding it and pounding it and pounding it. And finally, people started growing afros and identifying. They said, "I'm black. Don't call me enough." Now we've, you know, evolved or whatever to African Americans, but I use them synonymously and interchangeable because I get tired of saying African-American, so I'll say black in a minute. But Henry Louis Gates, although he has been a champion of some, in some respects, has been a severe disappointment in others. I'll just leave it at that.
I like that answer. That was a very diplomatic and very judicial answer, and I'm going to leave it at that. Your Honor, I know you said you would be with us for another hour.
We're almost done.
If you got five more minutes, tell us what you think is most important Some very important things as we close out Ramadan and close this program out. You have 5 minutes to make your presentation to the court of public opinion. Why? Just give your case.
All right. Thank you very much, Brother Imam. As I reflect upon the challenges that we have today, from the killings in Chicago to that terrible arrest and basically murder of that brother up in New York recently, who was called a gentle giant, I don't have his name, to what's happening in Palestine, the Middle East, to the shooting down of that plane in Ukraine. All over the world, there's so many challenges, but we can assist those in resolution by sending what funds we can, when we can, and by speaking out when we can. But what we need to do is work on our own selves, and that's what Ramadan, this beautiful month of fasting that the Muslims have, in which Christians can join. I've had Christians join me in fasting for 2 or 3 days because it's such a wonderful regimen. It gives the body a rest. The digestive system gets a chance to rest. Can you imagine a vacation for 16 hours a day for the digestive system? They're like, hoorah. But in this Ramadan where we reflect, what we need to do is work on ourselves, first of all, and then, and this is my main point, Brother Imam, is work on our families. First of all, if you are about to be married, make a commitment to get married and stay married. Work on the institution of marriage. God will bless you. See, people don't understand that God has established marriage as a divine institution. So it gets a boost. It's like a turbo institution. You know, you're dating, that's a relationship. And you are, you know, maybe even shacking together, that's a relationship. But when you marry because of the commitment, you get an extra dose, extra dispensation of blessings. And you begin to take on, I'm telling you, a good marriage is the closest thing to heaven that there is on this earth, period. And it lasts, the bliss that you have from a marriage lasts not for just 1 hour, not just for some sexual seance or some encounter. That's fleeting. That goes. But the peace of mind that you have while you're walking around with the comfort of having a mate across town to be on the same wavelength with you, to be your ally, to be your comfort, to be your sucker when you come home, to have that peace. That is paradise. That's close as you're going to get. So if you've got it, like Sade says, yeah, heaven's sake, hang on to your love. And then from that, develop a family. Honor your family structure. If you don't have an immediate father and mother, have somebody who will serve as a surrogate. And then raise the children. Spend time with your children. Read to your children. Nurture your children. Groom your children. Feed your children. And stop this wasteland of unsupervised kids and children who don't know any discipline. So I believe that our future lies in restoring our family structure to what it was in the 40s, in the 50s, and even before. And then on a national level, first state, maybe local, convening a Congress, convening our own session to address our own problems and looking at the effects of slavery on the African-American psyche and development. And then once we do that, we can also join in with John Conyers and demand some reparations. For example, a tuition-free education for all children of slaves and ex-slaves, all the descendants. We all should be going to college without these big student loans. African-American kids deserve at least a free education so that we can try to take our place and bind up the wounds that ail us in society. So, but we can't do that on the weak basis that we have now. We have to get stronger. and our family structure needs that attention first. So those are some of the things that I'd like to see done, Brother Imam Alfred Muhammad. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to share them with your audience.
Would you also join me in requesting that any African-American that has been descendants of slaves also be given free psychotherapy and family therapy? I mean,
well, that's part of it. Because if you put the ex-slave on the couch, you find that we suffer from the burden of being black in America is itself enough to drive somebody crazy. So
that's right.
We got to deal with that, plus all of the other psychological issues that confront everybody. From you know, stress is the new normal, as they say now. One of our Bar Association president wrote that beautiful saying: "Stress is the new normal." So we all.
And you know what? And I refuse to accept that. I think that Satan whispered that. Stress is not the new normal. It should be abnormal.
But it is normal now because everybody's suffering from it.
With those words, Your Honor, well, you've eased a lot of our stress. We really thank you for coming by here. I know you're busy in the courts and in your chambers. I pray God blesses his mercy on you and also upon your intern that's with you visiting from Egypt, Akhir Alam Asalam. We hope to visit right in the district with you all real soon. One day you may see a person sitting in the back of the court with a balding head, and you know it's me observing and smiling. But every time I go in the court, it makes me feel so proud to see an African-American judge. Because I grew up in the days when we didn't have African-American judges.
But can you imagine, brother, somebody coming into my courtroom, and I see him in hijab or whatever, and I say, assalamu alaikum? I mean, it's a miraculous. And I thank Governor Glendinning. First of all, and then Governor O'Malley, Governor Glendinning appointed me in 2000. Governor O'Malley elevated me to the circuit court in 2011 so that I can be of great service to a huge part of the population that never had this before, and, of course, a service to all the people. It doesn't matter, Christian, Jews, everyone is equal before the law. And
That's right.
Wonderful platform on which to dispense justice and
And you know, I wanted to say this. I got to drop a commercial for Imam Muhammad. Imam Muhammad said, in Jalso, the word Magdalene comes from that word. When a man is sitting, he said, Allah is telling us in the Salat that when you're riding or sitting, so he's not talking about just sitting down. When you sit as a judge, when you sit as a person in charge, you there's a prayer that we say, and we ask God to forgive us, have mercy on us, to give us our provision, purify us, and lastly, take us to the heights. Because as you judge, you need to be taken to the heights. May God bless us and mercy be upon you. Thank you. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. You've listened once again. And Judge, we'll make sure you get a copy of that tape. Thank you. Thank you so much. As-salamu alaykum.
Wa alaykum as-salam.